Well, I'm going to be kind of taking an approach that I did last time, which is, if you remember with, as we were talking about, is there a God? I know that some of you had some major problems with point number two that I had about the moral argument of if there's a God. And I can understand that. But it's interesting when you take point one, two, and three, and you put all of them together, it's not just that one is good, or two is good, or three is good. You put it all together kind of in this big old piece of pie, and you're going to have a full pie that is just compelling. And that's what I'm going to be doing today, kind of four major questions. And you might even have some problems with one or the other, and man, maybe I won't even be able to answer them as well as you would like them to. But when you take the thing in its totality, you're going to find out really quickly that it is very hard to dispute stuff about the Bible. So we're going to dive into it. Stop me anytime, ask questions, and we'll just go from there. Because the first question that most people, one of the major concerns that most people have is it reliable? How do we know that the stuff that we have here is what Jesus actually read or was actually written at the time that people say that it was written? How can we trust the words of this book? And so that's where we're going to start off there. Is it reliable? Can we trust that what we have here is what was accurately been transmitted for hundreds and hundreds of years? All right. One of the major complaints that most people start off with is they say, guess what? We don't have any originals. And you know what? You are absolutely correct. There are no original manuscripts of any book of the Bible. Absolutely none whatsoever. And that should not shake your faith because you have to understand exactly how these copies came about. All that we have are what are called copies. So if someone was copying a manuscript, if they had the original here and a copy here, that we don't have any of the originals. All we have are copies. Now, we're fixated on originals, right? If I brought up a baseball and said, wow, I've got a copy of the 62nd home run that Mark McGwire hit a couple years ago, you would say, what did we do about the copy? If you have the original, well, then you're a millionaire, and you're very excited. If I said I have a copy of the book Mein Kampf that Hitler wrote while he was in prison, you would say, whoop-diddly-doo, I don't care about a copy, I want the original. And that's not how they thought back in those days. You first of all got to remember exactly what these materials were written on. They would use a papyrus or very fragile paper. Sometimes they would use animal skins. Sometimes they would use tablets or stone. And what would often happen with some of these materials is they're very fragile. So if you were writing on animal skin and you preserved it for, you know, let's say 100 years, eventually the animal skin is going to rot and deteriorate. The papyrus is going to get fragile and thin and start crumbling all over the place. Back in those days, originals were not important. You got to remember that if you were copying and this one was deteriorating and you said, wow, I have an exact copy from here to here, well, then I could take the original, crumple it up, and throw it away. Because now I've got something that's written on fresher paper, fresher animal skin, and because of that, it's going to stay a lot longer. So don't let anyone tell you that because we don't have any originals, that should not matter to us. Because to them, copies were just as good as the original. Actually, they were even considered better than the original. So we don't have any originals, but we have copies. Manuscripts. And let's take a look at those. The New Testament. What I've done here is I have listed out for you a bunch of ancient writers and some of the information about them. When you take a look at an ancient classic piece of work, what you really need to understand is you've got to find out when it was written, when do you have the earliest copy, because that's going to determine the time span. Now, which would you rather have? Would you rather have a time span that is longer or shorter between the original and the copy? Shorter, right? Because if it was closer to the original, it's probably a little bit more reliable. You could, you know, maybe there's a little bit less chance for error to come up. And then if you had copies, number of copies, would you want more copies or less copies? You'd want more. The reason why? Because if I have three copies, I have to somehow determine what the original was based on three copies. If I have 60 copies, I can lay them all out and compare one to another, and if 59 of them say this and one of them has a word out of place, I would probably deduce that this one had a transmission of error, and the guy just either slipped the pen or forgot or lost his place in the copying process, and I could determine which one was more reliable. So as you take a look at some of these people, I chose a couple. I had a huge long list, and then Chris said, no, I don't know any of these people. And you're right, I didn't know half these people either. But we know who Caesar, Plato, Demosthenes, Pliny the Younger. I threw him in there because he's just an interest. I like the name Pliny. Pliny? Name your next child Pliny. Pliny the Younger, he was a historian. And it has there when they wrote, when we have an early copy of something that they wrote, then the time span and the number of copies. So you could just glance through it, and you're going to say which book or which piece of literature is the best when it comes to the time span. Pliny the Younger, right? Only 750 years between when he wrote and when we have the earliest copy. Oh, also, just to let you know about that whole original thing, we don't have any originals of any ancient piece of literature either. No originals. Why? The same reason that we don't have any originals of the Bible, because they just didn't rely on them. They had, the copy was much better. So, if you take a look at Pliny the Younger, he only has 750 years between the time span. That's pretty good, especially compared to the other guys. Now, who has the best when it comes to the number of copies? Demosthenes. 200 copies. You could lay all 200 copies out and start comparing back and forth, and you're probably going to come up with the original, don't you think? And that 200, that is a lot of copies. You can see what the normal, when it comes to ancient literature, the normal is anywhere between 2 and 10. That's the normal. But Demosthenes, we have 200 copies. Okay, now I've got two more there. Homer and the Iliad. And I want you to fill this stuff in. I got it up here on PowerPoint. So we got Homer, the Iliad. So write down when it was written. And it was written, I can't even read that one, 900 B.C. That's when he wrote the Iliad. Now, we have a copy. When was that earliest copy? 400 B.C. Quick math. You have how many years? 500 years. What do you think? 500 years? That's pretty good, especially compared to most ancient literature. 500 years, you've shortened the time span by in half of most of these things. Now, you want to see the number of copies? Check this out. 643 copies. So we can be relatively certain that we can determine what Homer originally wrote in the Iliad because we have all those copies. Okay, now we come to the New Testament. Here we go. When was the New Testament written? It was written 40 to 100 A.D. Most scholars nowadays don't even come close with dating any of the works of the New Testament later than 100 A.D. There's just so much proof that shows that they couldn't, especially because of the fall of Jerusalem that happened in 70 A.D. That's kind of the measuring stick. So the New Testament was practically finished around 100. It was started around 40 A.D., which was pretty close to the time of Christ, too, right? Christ probably died, we're guessing, around 33 A.D., right? Okay, so when was our earliest copy? 125 A.D. Quick math, what do you get? 25 years. Wow. Compare that to any other ancient piece of literature. We have the earliest copy, the shortest time span of any ancient piece of literature. And now you're ready for the big one. Number of copies. Survey says 24,633. Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. It doesn't even compare. There is no other ancient piece of literature that even comes close. There is nothing that even comes close to the number of copies. The best one behind that is Homer's Iliad, 643 copies. We blow them away. 24,000 copies. Do you think we can determine what the original actually said? Oh, you betcha. They can lay them all out, and they have, and they've done. Yes, please.
Is there any indication how many of those number of copies, those 24,000, are copies of copies? I mean, we're assuming that all 24,000 were from the original.
Oh, no. We would not say that those were all 24,000 from the original. Correct, yeah. I couldn't tell you how much, because I don't think even they would know, because, again, to them, if a copy they believe was like the original, it was as good as the original. So, yeah, those go even later on because it was translated into numerous different languages and found in numerous different parts. So, yeah, good question, though. But that's also with all the other ones, too. We can't even determine if it was a copy of a copy of a copy or if it was someone was actually sitting with the original. Yeah, we're not sure. Good question. All right, should be a black slide. Good. All right. So when you take a look at the New Testament, it does not compare to anything else in ancient world. In fact, you could categorically make this statement. You want to throw off the New Testament and say that's unreliable? You've just thrown out every piece of ancient literature we have in this world. Because you can't compare. You cannot compare. So if you believe that Caesar wrote what Caesar wrote, and that what we have is what we have, then you have to believe. It's a natural, logical following that the New Testament is accurate, it's reliable, based mainly upon the fact that we have 24,000 copies. All right, Old Testament. Now, that's the New Testament. Now, let's move into the Old Testament a little bit. I want to tell you a little about some two groups of people that I thought were pretty fascinating, the Talmudists and the Masoretes. These were a group of people. The Talmudists lived about 100 A.D. to 500 A.D., and the Masoretes from 500 A.D. to about 1,000 A.D. They are a group of people that were fanatics. Now, you want to talk about religious fanatics. These guys were so fanatical about what they were writing. Their job, their only job in life, was to copy books of the Bible. That was it. They copied Old Testament, they copied mainly the Old Testament because they were Jewish people, and because they were Jewish, they didn't believe in the New Testament, so they copied constantly the books of the Bible. Now, let me tell you a little about some of their stringent methods. Let's imagine if you guys were my little Masoretes class. Here, hold on to this piece of paper for me. You're my little Masoretes class, and today we are going to copy the book of Ezra. Okay? And so you guys are all there, and I have somewhere, you have a copy, and you are copying word for word what Ezra's saying, boom, 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 boom. All right. And someone finally finishes, and they raise their hand. Rabbi Manning, I'm done with the book of Ezra. And I say, wonderful. And I just don't take your copy and say thank you. I say, let's check it out. It's like a strict school teacher saying, I'm not going to just believe you. I'm going to test you on this. And so I ask you, I say, okay, how many words do you have in the book of Ezra? And you, okay, I have about 12,333 words. And I look at my little cheat sheet because this has all been calculated out billions of times before. You are exactly right. That is exactly how many words are supposed to be in the book of Ezra. Can you please tell me how many letters? 36,541. Ah, very good. Can you please tell me the middle word of the book of Ezra? It's aor, light. Very good, very good. Can you please tell me how many hays you had in your book? It's a Hebrew letter. How many hays did you have? Well, I had 541. Oh, I'm sorry. There's 542 hays. You're off by one. I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry about that. And they would literally take their thing, tear it up, give them a fresh piece of paper, and say, good luck next time. You aren't a millionaire this time, right? I mean, it's brutal what they would do. They even had rules about if a king entered the room where a Talmudist was copying the Old Testament and started to imagine if the President of the United States walked in this door and you were copying the stuff and he said, hey, I got a question for you. You were not allowed to look at him. They were that strict. Because if you did, you might mess up where you are in the copy of the manuscript. So if someone even addresses you, you're supposed to ignore them. Now, I think we should institute that rule for all schools everywhere, right? A principal walks into the room. You don't have to look up. No, I'm just kidding. So I didn't just tear up my... Oh, my gosh. I knew... Oh, my gosh. Please don't tell me. Did I tear up my... I did. I tore up my copy. See all my notes in there? Who needs notes, right? Okay. Now I'm going to have to go back. Now I don't have notes for the next service either. But that's okay, because I'll just have to do another sheet here. Okay. All right. So that's the Talmudists and the Masoretes. They were so strict on how they had the rules. They had lists of rules that you had to use fresh animal skin and that you had to use certain ligaments in order to tie those skins together, and they couldn't be frail and fragile. And you couldn't look up if a king addressed you, and you had to use certain type of ink. It had to be black ink. It couldn't be pigmented with any other color. Rules upon rules upon rules, because they were so fanatical about copying it word for word, letter for letter. That's how fanatical they were. And the Dead Sea Scrolls were something that caused us to trust the Masoretic text that has been transmitted. Dead Sea Scrolls. Let me tell you a quick story about how it happened. Shepherd boy, lost a couple of his sheep. He's walking around some caves by a town called Qumran, and he thinks maybe one of them wandered in there, so he takes a couple rocks and he chucks it in there to see if the sheep I don't know, maybe the sheep will go, ah, hey, stop throwing rocks at me. So he's chucking a few rocks in there, and all of a sudden he hears this, I don't know how to make pottery, the glass sound. It was a piece of pottery, and it shattered. And he went, well, what was that? So he wanders inside, and he finds a bunch of scrolls, mostly about the book of Isaiah. And he goes, wow, this is pretty cool. He goes in, and then they're finally put up in museums, and they date the scrolls. Look at this. You can see the one scroll. The impact of this discovery is in the exactness of the Isaiah scroll. 125 B.C., that's when they dated it. 125 B.C. That's pretty early, especially since the earliest copy we had at that point was the Masoretic text, which was written when? 916 A.D. So this is a pretty good litmus test. It actually started scaring biblical scholars out of their shoes because they said, oh my goodness, we've got the Masoretic text here that we've been trusting for so long, and now we have an Isaiah scroll dated 125 B.C., 1,000 years. What mistakes are we going to find? How reliable is that Masoretic text to this scroll of 125? And so they examined it. Check out this. They looked at Isaiah 53. There's 166 words in Isaiah 53. And out of those 166 words, 17 letters are in question. 17 letters. Now, check this out. 10 of the letters are simply a matter of spelling. They have the same spelling thing that we have. If I told you to spell the word honor, and you said H-O-N-O-U-R, are you incorrect? No. You can spell honor, H-O-N-O-U-R, or H-O-N-O-R. You can spell it either way. And so the 10 of those letters were simply spelling changes, but it was the same word. So 10 out of the 17 are spelling. 4 are stylistic changes, such as conjunctions. If you had the word in English, can't, and you had a copy that said cannot, is it a mistake? No, it's a conjunction. You just take it and combine it. You could do the same thing in Hebrew and in Greek, and I'll even show you a little bit later how they do that in Greek. So, 4 of the letters are stylistic changes, such as conjunctions. Does not change the meaning of the words at all. So, 14 out of 17, easily explained. The 3 remaining letters comprise the word light, aor, which is added in verse 11. And as you can imagine, one word inserted in that does not greatly affect the meaning. It's not like it says, you know, and someday there will come a God who will eat you all with ravaging teeth or something like that. The word light was added. That was all. It was simple. So when you take a look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, they were major advancements in the Christian faith because we were so confident about the Masoretic text, 1,000 years of copying, and that's all that happened. Pretty crazy. So when you take a look at the Old Testament and how fanatical they were about copying it and how exact they were to some of the earliest copies we have, you can see very quickly that that is a very reliable thing. Now, some people ask about variations. They say, I heard a statement, check this out, I heard a statement that there were over 200,000 variations, differences between the copies. And you know what? They're right. 200,000. That's an awful lot of variations, don't you think? Not really. Check this out. Out of the variations, this is how they calculated. Now, I tried to do this. It's really hard to see these underlined words. This is taken from John chapter 1, 3. All things through him were made, and there was nothing that was made that he did not make. Pretty good, huh? Yeah, check me out on that. Yeah, who speaks Greek? Okay, and the big thing that I wanted you to look at was right here. If you look at it on your... Oh, you don't have a piece of paper. This two-word right here, this is pronounced uda en, two words, and then there's a variation on it. That's why there's an English word or uden. What is the difference between these two? The conjunction. You put an E and an E together, and in Greek rules, you can either keep them separated, cannot, or you can combine them, can't. Now, this is a variation. Is this really a variation? Yeah, it's a difference between the copies of the manuscript, but is it a mistake? No. And if there were 3,000 manuscripts that had this difference, you know, that's how they calculated it. They said, oh, there's 3,000 variations. That's how they got to such an inflated number of 200,000 variations. It's really not 200,000. You want to know how many it is? It's really only about 400 places. But because we have 24,633 copies... Oh my goodness, the variation starts shooting through the roof. They don't have that in the other ancient literature because there's not enough copies. So it's only about 400 places when calculated out. That's 0.5% when you take a look at the Bible. Oh, my goodness. This is better than ivory soap. 99.44% pure. The Bible, 99.5% pure. You take that against any ancient piece of literature, and usually the differences are around 5%. That's a standard. If you had some copies and some stuff, ancient literature would say you could have up to 5% corruption, and you would still be deemed as a reliable source. And what do we have? 0.5%. People, what you hold in your hands, you can be confident that this is what was originally written. We may not have the originals. There may be 200,000 variations, but it really isn't. This is the most purest, most reliable document that we have in all of ancient literature. Next slide should be black. Any questions on that? It's tough when you start researching this stuff. It's hard to refute. It's hard to say that this is an unreliable piece of work. Now, that kind of dovetails right into the next section. You can say confidently that what you have here is a reliable source. We have so many copies. We have so few variations. We have so many people copying it with such stringent work that this is what it is. But some people say, well, wait a second. It's just like Homer's Iliad. We can be confident that Homer wrote Iliad and that what we have is what it is. But is Iliad... I'm skipping ahead. Is it historical? Let's first of all talk about why these books and not others. Because there are other books out there that tried to make it into the Bible. There's like a little competition of who can write the most letters to try and get it into the Bible. And they got some really cool stuff. And so I'm gonna talk a little bit about how the canon was developed. Why do we have these 66 books in the Bible, and why not the others? Well, a lot of people believe that a council one day said, you know what, we need to decide which books are supposed to be in the Bible, and you know what, there's a lot of real fake stuff out there, and we really want to keep our thumbs down on these Christians, and so we're going to really constrain, we're going to say, these are your books, and just suck it up, and too bad, right? And that's how they believe that the canon was developed, and that is completely not the case. What had happened was people were using these scrolls and these books for so many years, but then all of a sudden there crept in a ton of these older books, later writings, like the Gospel of Thomas and the Secret Mark and the Gospel of Mary Magdalene and the Cross Gospel, and all these weird things started popping up, and so they had to make a decision. Well, we better find out exactly what should be in there and what shouldn't be in there. And so what they did, they made a poll. They started asking churches all over the known world at that time, which ones are you using? Well, and these people were eyewitnesses. Most of them were still alive. And they'd actually seen Jesus with their own eyes. If they hadn't, their dad had seen him. And so they said, oh, well, it's really simple. This stuff over here is real fake. But this stuff, no, this is what we go by. This is what we determine. And so that's how the canon was developed. It was not developed by some high and mighty council issuing some monstrous decree to control the people. The people, the Christians, the eyewitnesses, determined what went in the Bible and what didn't.
How did the Catholic Church end up with some of the books?
Yeah, because there was this set of books that were disputed. And that's where we got the word apocrypha. And that's on the next line, apocrypha. So when some groups started getting together and started to try and analyze which ones are which ones, the Catholic Church took in a bunch of books that were disputed. And the Protestant faith just didn't. They said, yeah, we just don't buy that. We just don't think that that's right. And so that's why if you pick up a Catholic Bible, in fact, I got one out of the books that we had there. There was one that had the Apocrypha in it. And it's mainly Old Testament historical books, Judith, Maccabees, stuff like that, Ecclesiasticus. And there's some pretty interesting stuff in there. Luther liked the Apocrypha, but only for devotional reading. We would never take an article of faith or a doctrine from one of those disputed books because it is disputed. Wouldn't it be better to take a piece of doctrine from something that was downright clear and understandable and everyone had already accepted it? And that's the reason why they have just a slightly different Bible than we do. They have the Apocrypha, and we don't recognize that because it was a disputed book. And there are even some disputed books that made it into the Bible. That shows you just how stringent some of these people were about making sure that what was transmitted was actually true. The book of James was highly disputed. The book of 2 and 3 John was highly disputed. But after a while, they came to the conclusion, after the eyewitnesses looked over and examined, they said, you know what, I think this is good. And so that's why that ended up in our Bible. Now, there's others that have never been disputed at any time, the Gospels and Romans and stuff like that. And then you got this body of literature called the Pseudepigrapha. That's where the cross gospel is. So let me tell you a quick little story that came out of the cross gospel. I guess what happened was when Jesus, when he came back to life, the stone got rolled away, and he was still in the tomb. And he kind of walks out, and all of a sudden he's like the Incredible Hulk, and he rises to the sky. And he's like, you know, 500 feet high, towering over everyone, speaking to them, right? And then guess what happens? The cross comes out of the tomb and starts talking. A talking cross. That's pretty fascinating. They sniffed that one out pretty fast, don't you think? No, I don't think that's right. I don't remember seeing a talking cross come out of the tomb after a 500-foot Jesus came out. No. So the cross gospel was quickly axed. And same thing with a lot of other ones. There's one that the Jesus Seminar tried to put in. There was the Gospel of Thomas, and it told women that you needed to become like men in order to enter the kingdom of heaven. Did great stuff for transsexual sex changes. It was amazing. But it said, women, be like men in order to inherit the kingdom of heaven. They compared that to what Jesus talked about and how he loved women and how he respected them, and they quickly came to the conclusion, I don't think that's what Jesus said. I was there, I heard it with my own ears, or my dad heard it, and because of that, that is not true. And that's how they sniffed those out. So, why these books and not others? Because of the people who were living at that time, developing them, and then how the Christian churches used them over the years, it was very easy to determine which ones were true and which ones were just plain old fiction. Yes?
In the beginning of my Bible, it lists all the, like there's a billion people that were involved in putting the King James Version that I have at home. I was just noticing.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, from all these different religions and backgrounds and everything, and they said that, you know, they spent all this time going over it.
That's why there's so many churches that that still hang on to that King James Version with dear life. They're like, look at all the people that worked on it. I just kind of love them. Wow, you know. And they think it's somehow holy and inspired. The King James Version, the New International Version, the Revised Standard Version, anytime you have what's called a translation is just that, a translation. What they did was they took, the King James Version took all the manuscripts and all the original the copies of the documents and laid them all out and translated it line by line. That's why it took so many people. Nowadays, guess what we have? Computers. We have all this catalog. My goodness, pretty easy. I could do that here. I could translate a ton of stuff because I just put my mouse over a Greek word, and whammo, up comes the translation. Man, I wish I had that in seminary. That would have saved me so much time. So, King James Version, NIV, those are what's called translations. Now, that's different than if you have the Living Bible, if you have the Contemporary English Version. Pardon? The Message, yes. Those are what we would call paraphrases. What they did was they took the NIV text or maybe the Revised Standard Version, and they just paraphrased it to contemporize the language. And those, I have to admit, they're great for devotional reading, but they're not quite true to the original languages. If you have a translation in NIV, you can be certain that they went back to the original languages to understand it. So that's a quick little lesson on translations versus paraphrases. Yes, John?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. In the Living Bible, the Good Samaritan takes the beat-up fellow to the inn and gives the innkeeper two $20 bills.
Oh, two $20 bills? They had those back then? Wow. Got change for a 50? Who's that on your bill? Oh, that's a president, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And there's other things some of the Genesis stuff when God was walking around and no one's ever been able to translate it right. And one of the paraphrases says, it was really hot outside. So God was walking around when there was a windy breeze. Oh my goodness gracious, we've just departed completely from what the original language has said. But they're trying to capture. So, and remember, the Living Bible came about because a guy was sick of trying to read some of the stuff back then. He only had the RSV. And so what he did was he paraphrased it for his kids, so that the kids can understand it better. And then everyone said, wow, I can actually understand that. Instead of this weird stuff in here, I can understand that story. Yeah, because when we say he gave them two shekels, everyone's like, what's a shekel? He gave them two $20 bills. Oh, gotcha. Okay, he paid for it. Yeah, that's what it's supposed to mean. So yeah, if you have those, you know, don't get all freaked out, you know, like you're going to have to go and throw them away. They're great for good reading. They really are. But if something comes up and you go, ooh, I don't know about that, just give me a buzz. Say, hey, I was looking at this verse, blah, blah, blah. What do you think? I can look up the original languages. You saw me. I could read Greek. Yes.
I've got a new American Standard. Where does that?
New American Standard is translation. New American Standard. Yeah. NASB. Yeah. There's only a few paraphrases out there because people don't trust paraphrases anymore. They want to go back to the original languages. Yes. So that's how the Bible was developed. That's why we chose these 66 books, because they were universally accepted at that time by the Christian faith, by eyewitnesses, and by people that trusted it. So you can be confident that the Gospel of Thomas and the Cross Gospel and the Secret Mark did not make it into it, and for very good reasons. One other cool story. No, I'm not going to go into it. Oh, I got so many good stories on that. Okay, now the question comes up. Here's that Iliad illustration of... So we have this book, so it was developed, so the canon was put together, but what if it was just all stories, right? Come on, the book of Jonah, a guy got eaten by a fish? I don't think so.
Still
happy? Okay, oh, look at that, here, you're going to come up here, you preach the sermon. Well, I'll debate with you a little bit. No, yeah, but that's where, yes, that has, I saw it happen in the 80s sometime, some lady got swallowed on some whale expedition. And
that, well, it isn't even just whales. As a matter of fact, the fish is a large grouper. It's called a jewfish.
A jewfish, okay. And ate a woman. Because I remember they did. Yeah, it is possible. And then they cut it open. She's like, hey. It did happen. It actually did happen. So, you know, Ripley's Believe It or Not. Yes, that's incredible. Yeah. So, most people, though, they look at it and they say, well, that's just a nice little story. Yeah, Jesus was the people were trying to write a good parable. I mean, didn't Jesus speak in a lot of parables? I mean, what if the Old Testament is just a bunch of parables? That's really probably what it is, right? Adam and Eve and an apple probably didn't happen. Just a nice little story. That's the objection. That's what we get. What they're saying is this, can this stuff be verified as historical events? The answer? Yes, they can. It's amazing, and this is how I'm going to verify it. Archaeology was huge on this. One of the big questions was the story of Jericho. Come on, people. A bunch of people walking around with an ark and blowing trumpets and shouting seven times, and all of a sudden walls fall down. Nice little story. It's just a parable talking about how good and powerful God is. And they have some backup. Check this out. Joshua 6, when the trumpet sounded, the people shouted, the wall collapsed, so every man charged straight in and took the city. And so many people said, that could never have happened. Why? How can you go straight into a city if the walls collapse? If you had a city surrounded by a big wall and you were besieging it, which way would the walls collapse? They'd collapse in. Yeah, you're battering ram it, and if it collapses, what is it going to hit? Yeah, buildings, houses, other walls, people, animals, it's really sad. How can you go straight into the city if these things, you would have to clamber over walls in order to do that. And they say, look at that. That's just a nice little story. It never really happened. Well, guess what? John Garstang was an archaeologist. He wrote a book called The Foundations of Bible History. It was written in the 30s, and he had actually excavated. He was there on site when they excavated Jericho at the time when this supposedly happened. Remember, they would have Jericho upon Jericho upon Jericho. If they liked a site, they'd just keep building on top of it. So they've been excavating and excavating, and they came to the time period that this was supposedly supposed to happen, and everyone was just chomping at the bit. Yeah, now we're going to prove once and for all that the Bible is just a nice little story because of this. And you know what happened? Check this out. During the excavations of Jericho, Garstang found something so startling that a statement of what was found was prepared and signed by himself and two other members of the team. As to the main, and this is quote, as to the main fact, then there remains no doubt. The walls fell outwards so completely that the attackers would be able to clamber up and over their ruins into the city. The walls fell out. Nice little story, or verified by archaeology. Amazing. Another thing that people like to dispute is the birth of Christ. I think I have that up here. Oh, I guess I don't. No, I don't have the birth of Christ? Okay, well, you guys all know the birth of Christ, right? Luke chapter 2, 1, 2, and 3, it said that while Quirinius was governor of Syria, they took a census of the whole Roman world, and everyone was ordered to go back to their hometown. Right, you know that? And people, historians always say, yeah, nice little story, never really happened. Quirinius was not governor of Syria around the time of Christ. Josephus specifically says that Quirinius became governor after Herod's death in 6 AD. Quirinius was not governor of Syria. Nice try, but no beans. And also, they never took censuses. That was back before the time that they even had that type of know-how and technology. And why would you take a census and send everyone back to their hometown? That does not make any sense whatsoever. Nice story, good try, but never really happened. You cannot verify it by historical evidence. And then, first of all, archaeological discoveries show that the Romans had regular enrollments of taxpayers and also held censuses, they found, every 14 years. It began under Augustus and first took place in 23 B.C. So were censuses taken during that time? They sure were. Second, a coin was found by archaeologist Jerry Vardaman that had the name Quirinius that placed him as governor of Syria around 11 B.C. And this was confirmed by an inscription found in Antioch that ascribed him as governor of Syria during the time of 7 B.C. The answer? Why do we have Josephus, a nice historian, saying it was 6 A.D., and we have stuff that says 7 B.C.? Well, tell me, when was George Bush president of the United States? Oh, do you think they actually might have reused names back then? Quirinius was probably a pretty popular name. Or he ran for government twice and got it. Very easy. And they had found the evidence. And then also, thirdly, an official government document found dated 104 AD from Gaius Vibius Maximus. I want that name. Marcius Menius Maximus. He was prefect of Egypt. And this is what it says. And I've read this in a couple of different places already. Seeing that the time has come for the house-to-house census, it is necessary to compel all those who, for any cause whatsoever, are residing out of their provinces to return to their own governments, that they may both carry out the regular order of census and may also attend diligently to the cultivation of their allotments. That's from John McCrae, professor of New Testament and archaeology. He's a consultant to TV networks and National Geographic, and that's what he's writing. So guess what? They found proof. Not only did they take censuses, not only was Quirinius governor of Syria at that time, but also people returned to their own hometown. Nice little story? No. Verified. Over and over. I could spend an hour easily going over all the archaeological stuff that they have discovered over and over and over again. But you know what? Let's take a look at the secular historians, right? Because we're just taking all our information from the Bible. Well, what did Lee do? Was Jesus really a man of history? Did this stuff, can this stuff be verified by secular historians? Guess what? It can. 11 references that I've seen. I've seen 11 references that include Tacitus, Lucian, Josephus, Suetonius, Pliny the Younger. There he is. Tertullian, Thallus, Phlegon, Mara Bar Serapin, Justin Martyr, and the Jewish Talmuds. Edwin Yamauchi, who has studied all these sources, was asked what would we be able to deduce about Jesus from these non-Christian sources. He is quoted as saying, "We would know that first, Jesus was a Jewish teacher. Second, many people believed that he performed healings and exorcisms. Third, some people believed he was the Messiah. Fourth, he was rejected by the Jewish leaders. Fifth, he was crucified under Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius. Sixth, despite the shameful death, his followers, who believed he was still alive, spread beyond Palestine so that there were multitudes of them in Rome by 64 AD. And seventh, all kinds of people from the cities and countryside, men and women, slave and free, worshipped him as God." We would be able to deduce all of that information just from the non-Christian sources written about Jesus. Is it verifiable? Did this stuff actually take place in history? Kind of looks that way, doesn't it? It's not just a bunch of nice little stories. Archaeologist after archaeologist has determined this. And guess what? Oh, you know what? It's unique to Christianity. It's unique to Christianity. Yeah, I forgot about that one. John Ankerberg and John Weldon, the Facts on the Mormon Church. This is what they wrote. No Book of Mormon cities have ever been located. Oh, I'm sorry, let me tell you about the Book of Mormon. Book of Mormon is not a doctrinal handbook. The Book of Mormon is a history of the American people before we landed and before the Native Americans got here too. So they have a huge history about how Christ appeared to them over here in America. And this is what they wrote. This is what they wrote. No Book of Mormon cities have ever been located. No Book of Mormon person, place, nation, or name has ever been found. No Book of Mormon artifacts. No Book of Mormon scriptures. No Book of Mormon inscriptions. Nothing which demonstrates the Book of Mormon is anything other than myth or invention has ever been found. Has ever been found. But what do we keep finding over and over and over and over again about the Bible? Every time they dig up a new city, they find a new coin or they find a new inscription and they find out, oh my goodness, this stuff actually took place. It is reliable, we can trust the books that are there, and it is verified through history. Questions on that? I'm sucking you down the road, aren't I? I'm taking you down the road that you can't come back from, and soon you're going to be trapped, and I'm going to look at you, and no, I'm not going to do anything. Okay, so, you have one more objection, don't you? It's a nice book. Yeah, okay, it's reliable, we can trust it. We can trust that what we have was original. We can trust that the books of the Bible that are in there are supposed to be in there. And we can actually even say that this is a matter of history, that it actually took place. It's not just a bunch of stories, but who really cares? Why are we asked to read this stupid thing? This is talking about a Jewish culture and an early church culture that has nothing to do with 2001 America, Orange County living. Why should I care that what is written in here? How can you bind me to this book? Especially since what? It is a radically different culture. I'll agree with you. It is a different culture. The Jewish culture and then the early church culture, totally different than what we have here. Some people have tried to say that what they've tried to do is take out some of the commands of Jesus because they say he was speaking to that culture at that time. If he was here, he would say something totally different. And I have to say, I don't know. Now, I will agree with this. If you take a look through the book of Leviticus, you are going to find out really quickly that they demanded certain things from that Israelite nation that we would never buy today. Do you know that you were not supposed to weave two different types of cloth together to make a shirt? Oh my gosh, no polyester blends! You know? It had to be pure fabric, 100%. If you were making a rope, you couldn't make a rope out of two or three different things. It had to be out of the same fabric. In those same things, right? The things about homosexuality, bestiality, adultery, and so people say, look, sky's the limit. If you're telling me that I cannot engage in a homosexual lifestyle, then you better take off that polyester shirt. And what do we do? What? Okay. If that's what it takes. You got to understand, first of all, that the stuff that was there written in the Old Testament was true. There's a lot of cultural stuff. But we find out some other things in the New Testament, and that's where these passages come up. Some people say homosexuality is never really mentioned in the Bible. Do you not know that the wicked will not inherit the kingdom of God, neither the sexually immoral, nor male prostitutes, nor homosexual offenders? The word for homosexual that they used, it really there's another way to translate it, and that's how they translated 1 Timothy, for adulterers and perverts. Because the original word didn't really actually mean homosexual, man with another man. What it was saying was a perversion of the original intent that God had designed, which was male and female. This doesn't sound, what is this called? It's called sound doctrine. So when you take a look at it, I think what you have to understand, first of all, you have to understand why God commanded, go ahead and go to the next one, it should be by, why God commanded those certain things. When the Israelites were told not to weave together a bunch of cloth or to weave together ropes, it was because God was trying to talk about purity. You have to stay pure, which is why when they came and conquered a nation and a people, they had to kill everyone. Women, children, the whole lot of them, because God wanted them to remain pure. It was not that he didn't want them to wear polyester blends. You have to understand why it was given. And that's why we can say, why is there such an offense about homosexuality? I'm just using this one because that's what Chris and I talked about a couple days ago. She says, well, what about this? It seems to be the one that's a hot topic. So we'll talk. Why homosexuality? Why was that given? Why were all those rules about don't have sex with animals, don't have sex with your mother's sister? Because it was a perversion, and that's what the original languages talk about. It was a perversion of the original intent. Yes, please.
Isn't that, but I've had a discussion with my friend, and she says that, because she's also Catholic.
Oh, God bless the Catholic. Yes.
She went to Catholic school. So it's, she says that, well, you know, everybody's going to hell. And I said, well, it's just a sin, and if you don't act upon the sin.
Oh, okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah, homosexuality, yeah.
If you're bored with it, I'm saying, all right, then if you don't act upon it.
Yeah, if we were going to, and actually Chris and I talked about this, about maybe doing a series, maybe entitling it The Untouchables, tackling some of these super difficult, touchy issues that we have nowadays. And yeah, I would agree with that, and we can understand homosexuality. I don't hate homosexuals. And actually, you know what I hate? I hate Christians who hate homosexuals. That bugs the bejeebers out. It's just like any other sin. Yes. And I don't care if you were born with it. God bless you. Wonderful. That doesn't get the murderer off when he says, I was born a murderer.
What?
I was born with lust. Oh, yeah, okay, you and every other person ever born. You're born with lust? Oh, wow, shocker, right? Yeah. We just say, don't act upon it. I have to keep myself in check. Because why? I was born in what we call sin. And because of that, I need to keep myself from doing that.
And if they act upon it and they ask for their forgiveness, it just puts them at the same level as everybody else.
Yeah, we're all just beggars, same place. We just happen to know where to find the food and the grace. Exactly. So when we talk about what does the Bible say and is it a cultural thing, it is cultural, but I don't want you to chuck out the whole Bible then, saying, oh, yeah, that was a nice little thing, but who cares? I have nothing. Nothing binds me then. Well, no, understand the culture. So many people shy away from the Old Testament because it's some places it's pretty wacky. But all that stuff was a demonstration of God's love and patience and future look towards a Messiah. And that's really the main purpose of the Old Testament, was to get us to the New Testament. And then some people say, what is the purpose of the Bible? Let's see the purpose of the Bible right here. Because John was writing and he says, you know what? We couldn't record the whole life of Jesus. That would be impossible. Just like no one could record your whole life, day by day, minute by minute, word by word. But these stories that were written down, they were written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. You want to know the purpose of Scripture? It's so that you have Christ, if you have life in his name. Go to the next slide. Yeah. Any questions on the Bible? Any concerns? Any debates? Please.
You kind of addressed this a little bit already.
Yes.
You know, the issue of these stories or not. I guess what my question is that if I read the Bible, everything I read in it, I should, I'm asking, should I take that all as literal? Like, this is actually what happens, is actually what's said. There's no room for, this is the gist of what's said, or this is the gist of what it's getting at, but maybe, I guess one of my things is looking at, even in Genesis, you know, the creation of the earth.
Yeah,
it's a question of, I mean, when I'm reading it, and reading it that way, that is literally what happens in that time frame, in that sequence.
Yeah, good question. Yeah, because a lot of people like to say, I would really like to kind of wiggle out of this stuff, because not everything in the Bible is literal. When Jesus says, I am the door, I don't think he was being literal. He wasn't some wooden door with a big old handle. No, that wasn't him. So what about especially the creation story? Now, what you have to do is you have to first of all ask the question, does it fit the genre of being something that could be a parable? When Jesus talks parables, he always says, the kingdom of heaven is like, sounds to me like he's not talking literally. He's talking about, let's get the gist of this whole thing and we'll understand it. You read the book of Genesis, reads like a historical textbook, especially when you get past Genesis 1. All of a sudden, you're in Genesis 2, 3, 4, 5, and you're talking about Abraham and Lot and Sarah and all these historical figures, and it sure sounds like a history textbook. Try read it sometime. Genesis is not about the creation of the world. That happens in there, but it's about a whole lot more. 50 chapters in the book of Genesis. And because the rest of the book, and there's no difference between Genesis 1 to 2 to 3, there's not like some big break, like, oh, and all of a sudden, okay, now we're going to get out of storytelling form. And that's the reason why when I take a look at the book of Genesis, I have to say, boy, this whole thing sounds historical. It sounds like a textbook. It doesn't sound like we're having any room in order to see if it's figurative. So that's how I usually answer. I have to understand the book. You know, Song of Solomon, there's a good example. If you ever want to woo a woman, read to her Song of Solomon. except for the part where her legs are like ivory towers. That might not be fitting for our culture nowadays. But Song of Solomon, yeah, a lot of the stuff in there, it sounds a little more figurative. We maybe have to understand it a little bit better. But when you take historical books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, they're all history textbooks. They just literally boom, 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 boom. This is what happened, and this is what happened, and this is what happened. And because, guess what, Jericho was found in the book of Joshua, in that same genre of book, they've also found other things that support Genesis chapter 14 and some of the stories of Abraham. It's just incredible. It's incredible that they've been actually able to find these things. It was actually rooted in history. So that's what I usually say to that. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yes.
This is kind of off the subject a little bit, but archaeologically, is that true? I don't know if anybody else saw it. They had that show about how they think they found Noah's Ark up there.
Oh, yeah, good old Mount Ararat.
Yeah,
I've seen some stuff on that.
That bogus?
You know, it's tough to tell. Because why? Who controls that territory? The Turks. And the Turks don't like excavations. The Turks aren't Christian. If they allow a bunch of Christians to go tromping up Mount Ararat and verify Noah's Ark, they're in big doo-doo. So, better, no excavations. You cannot go up that mountain. There's even a no-fly zone. Now, I'm getting fascinated because we're putting satellites into space that we could zero down on, like the Hollywood sign. I'm like, come on, people! Just, you know, right down there to Mount Air. Let's take a look at this thing. But I have read information, and I will give that to you if you'd like. Information that talks about before the Turks took that over, there were some excavations. They found pieces of wood. They had people saying there was this boat-type structure up there, and they couldn't understand what it was. They dated some of it, and they found out it was the time of Noah's Ark. They're like, I wonder if this is Noah's Ark. And all of a sudden, whammo, everything was cut off because they took over. So I have that information. It's pretty fascinating.
There's Christian groups been going up there for over 100 years. However, there's a new group that's been up Ararat and says it's not on Ararat. That Ararat wasn't named Ararat until 60 years ago, and they think they found a place in Iran or Iraq.
Yeah, it's really tough sometimes because mountains usually don't have inscriptions on them, right? You know, if we're excavating Jericho and it says, this is Jericho, you know, now we got a pretty good idea, but the mountains, yeah, it's tough sometimes. What we do is we let archaeology do its job. When archaeology does it, let me tell you, the majority of these archaeologists are very dispassionate. They're passionate about uncovering the truth and the archaeological evidence. They don't care which side it lands on most of the times. So when they come up with some of these discoveries and they keep verifying over and over and over again that Christianity is true, it's valid, it's right, watch out. Any other questions about the Bible? Yes?
Just a statement that Mount Sinai the same way.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody knows what Mount Sinai is. And a lot of groups dispute the place that's put in your Bible.
Oh.
That's not, you know, inspired by God anyway.
Yeah. Which mountain is Mount Sinai is not a matter of doctrine or faith. Because it's in a book that has all this other archaeological evidence pointing to it, why should we dispute it? Why should we say the Bible got it right here and then didn't get it right over here? That just doesn't make any sense. Archaeology finds it over and over and over again. So, is the Bible reliable? Can we trust that what we have written here is actually what is written here? Yeah, the evidence is overwhelming. Can we trust it? Yes, please, Carol! Here I was going in.
I want to know this. Okay.
Yes, please.
Adam and Eve had children. Cain killed Abel. Cain went off to some other place and found a wife. Where did she come from?
Where did who come from?
The wife. And the seven times.
This one's really hard for us, I have to admit. Because, yes, brothers and sisters at that time,
they have a whole cup of silver. Did they not?
Well, yeah, no, that also takes over. Remember back in those days, how long did people live? Right? Right? Who is the oldest known person in the Bible that we have recorded? A guy by the name of Methuselah, 969 years. Talk about going through a midlife crisis. I'm 400 years old. I need a new car, you know? This poor guy, after 400 years. I want to know how long the teenage years were. I mean, that would just be fascinating to me. I mean, did he just have puberty, like, for, you know, 30, 40, 500 years? I don't know. I don't know. These are questions I ask. What can I say? So, yes, yeah, what happened was Adam and Eve probably... You know, I mean, if she's, you know, fertile for 500 years, I mean, my goodness gracious. But it is funny because gene scientists have found that back then the gene pool could have been so deep that you brother and sister could marry, have sexual relationships and have children, and they don't come out with like five eyeballs or anything like that. So they have been able to show that. And yeah, Cain killed Abel, Cain went off, but that was not where the line ended. Also remember the messianic line, Jesus, we know for certain that Adam and Eve had another child named Seth. And Seth was where that line came from. Now we know that they had a ton of others. And then yeah, they populated cities and stuff like that. I guess after 500 years, you'd probably do that kind of stuff. And then it was only after, I think like in the 1600s, that we started looking at gene pool stuff and foreheads started coming out really weird and stuff like that. So that's when we started doing it. Now you can only, you know, marry your second cousin. Isn't that right, John? John is the second cousin of my wife, so they talked about how they could get married and have decent looking kids. But I'm glad I married Heather and John married Shannon. Yes. It was good.
Well, since God only made one couple, they had to intermarry. But since there was really no time for genetic defects to come into the system, it would not have been a problem then. Also, since they were having so many children, it could have been his fifth cousin.
Oh, who knows? Yeah, who knows exactly how that all came about, because they didn't really care about stuff like that back then. We're interested because we're in the 20th century. Yeah. 21st century. I'm a century behind already.
Well, I mean, if we're after a flood and just Noah and his sons and daughters, and we're all...
Yeah, it happened again. It's like, ew, it happened again, Noah. But at that time, Noah's sons had married, and so the wives came on, so they were probably separated. But yeah, then they just sat around all day long, just, you know, cranking out a bunch of kids.
If all of us in the room came from there, somehow we're related.
We're all related.
You're 563rd cousin, 445 times removed. Yeah, who knows? Yeah. So, is the Bible reliable? Can we trust this thing? Why these books and not others? Can we trust that these books are the ones that we have? Yes. Is it verified by archaeology and historicity? Yes. Is it relevant for me today? Yes. Why do we have it? So that you may have life in Jesus Christ, and have it abundantly. If you have any other questions, you can always stop me and ask me. I'd be glad to go through this stuff. And I can also tell you this. Everything that I've written here, I made none of this stuff up. This all came from people much smarter than I, textbooks, academic works. I can show you every single source. The Bible is true, it's reliable, it gives us Jesus Christ.